Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community to prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to mecu.com for more information. Reminding you now that on Thursday, we'll begin our program with our special MeQ programs every week, talking about financial literacy and how you can control and save your money. That comes later in the week. We are talking this hour about two very interesting topics, one taking place in Baltimore County, which is emblematic of things going on around the state and around the nation, with our water being polluted and contaminated by sometimes big farms, but this time we're talking about big oil, and we're going to talk about that. And then we'll talk about the case of Mark Hall at the end of the hour, who is an African-American soldier who served two tours of duty in Iraq, came back. They wanted to put him in Iraq for the third time. He opposed it. He didn't want to go, but he was willing to go. But he wrote a song, and the song landed him in the brig while his troops went back to Iraq. We're going to talk about that and more in the last part of our program. But right now, we are joined by Legina. Is that right?
Correct.
Legina, yes. Legina and Tom Fasanoli, who are residents of Jacksonville, Maryland. They were co-plaintiffs in the suit against ExxonMobil for contaminating their well. And Jason Tamal joins us by phone. Jason is an associate at the law firm of Snyder & Snyder. He represented the Jacksonville residents in their suit against ExxonMobil. And Jason, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Good. I have to list disclaimer all the time. I know Jason. And I knew him before he could speak.
Indeed. You're an old family friend.
And we should be clear about that and let that out.
Yeah. That's it. Glad to be on the show, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Now, we asked Exxon to come on, and Exxon declined. But Exxon said that tomorrow there's going to be some earth-shaking announcement about this event, which we'll find out tomorrow. And when it is, we'll clearly bring that on the air and let you know what that is. The Maryland Department of the Environment was also asked to come on the program. They could not send anybody, and we'll read their statement in just a minute here on the air so you can hear what they had to say. But give us a sense, Jason, if you would start with us, about what this lawsuit was about and why it was fought and how you won.
Well, in early 2006, there was a gas leak at the Jacksonville Exxon station in Four Corners, and it didn't get discovered for 37 days, and the reasons it didn't get discovered are still a mystery to us. What came out through the course of the trial, however, is that the spill should never have happened. There was an antiquated alarm system that should have been replaced and wasn't, and as a result of that, these people who unwittingly became subject to a 27,000-gallon toxic catastrophe. And throughout the process, many of our clients and the residents of Jacksonville put faith in Exxon to do what they promised, and that was to make things right and to try to clean up and to be a good neighbor. And what Exxon requested in the way of discontinuing tests and providing bottled water is simply unconscionable. Start with the first premise that there's still gasoline in the ground in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
End of story. The second reality is that every time you test a water well in that neighborhood, you're going to get a slightly different and perhaps a vastly different result because you're testing moving water in an aquifer. So those levels will go up, they'll go down. And so there's no question that the well should be continued to be tested for quite some time. The other reality is that because of the process of remediation, the contamination, if you will, is on a suction. It's being pulled up. They're processing about 80,000 gallons of water per day, and that's keeping the contamination at an elevated level. So you're going to have residents that won't have contamination in their water well particularly, but they'll be large, hundreds of thousands of parts of contamination in their monitoring wells, which is on their property. The difference is that the monitoring wells are maybe 30 feet deep as opposed to the drinking wells, which are further. So when you stop testing, you have no way, none whatsoever, of knowing whether the water wells will become, the drinking wells will become contaminated, and you have no way of knowing whether the monitoring well levels will go up. And for a company to come in and do this to these people, force them to live in this water, to bathe in it, feed it to their kids, the least concession that they can make is to test the water and provide bottled water. And to ask to be excused to do that is a disgrace. And I commend Governor O'Malley for asking the MDE to reconsider their position.
And this is what the MDE statement is. We'll read on the air, then we'll turn to Legina and Tom Fasanoli to talk about their experiences and what they went through. After a 2006 spill of more than 25,000 gallons of gasoline at ExxonMobil's Jacksonville service station in Baltimore County, 12 residential wells were contaminated at levels above Maryland action level of 20 parts per billion of methyl tertiary butyl ether, MTBEs. Each one of those wells has treatment systems to remove the contamination, and the regular monitoring data shows these systems are working. ExxonMobil provided bottled water to other residents in the area, not a public health requirement. ExxonMobil initiated that action after 4 years of sampling data and the installation of water treatment systems at the four residences that at one time did exceed the state action level. The department determined that all of the 126 homes affected by this decision have safe drinking water. Because the data has shown that the well water for these homes is safe, the department approved discontinuing bottled water to the 126 homes. In addition, MDE approved discontinuing the sampling of 130 private supply wells that are at the perimeter of the plume. There remains in place a system of 262 monitoring wells that continue to be sampled regularly and that act as sentries to monitor any potential movement of the plume. As part of the continuing cleanup work at the site, the contamination plume has been well-defined and is being reduced and is being extensively monitored with 262 monitoring wells in place. Your reactions to that statement, Legina and Tom?
Well, that could be vast. I would take issue with several things there. You mentioned that the plume has been defined, and I'm sure that Jason could speak to this probably more in more detail, but I have heard recently, as you may know, there's another
lawsuit
that's in action, and some of those wells have tested at quite high parts per billion, which are outside what they're defining there as the plume. And I guess the big thing, though, that I would say as a resident that has to live through this is that they don't know, the MDE, the Maryland Department of Environment, doesn't really know. They've somehow come up with this measurement of 20 parts per billion being safe, but we're the ones that have to live with a contamination. We didn't have any MTBE in our wells prior to this event, and now we do and have continued to have that. And as Jason mentioned, the levels go up and down. Yes, our levels are below 20 parts per billion, but what is really safe? So we are essentially the living guinea pigs of what we're going to find out over a period of 10, 20, 30 years if we end up having to live there that long.
So, and Legina, I was thinking about a couple of things. I mean, just one thing I read was that the ExxonMobil has to pay you all to get, on a regular basis, four tests for four different kinds of cancer. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, and you live with that?
Well, I have no choice. I mean, it's like I sit in court. You think about, would they put their family there, any of these lawyers for Exxon, anybody that works for the Maryland Department of Environment, would they put their families there? How safe would they feel? But like my husband said, we are the guinea pigs. And where are we going to go? And what's the moral value? If I was able to sell my home and I put another family in there, how would I feel? I mean, so they should have came out, knocked on our doors the day it happened and said, we want everyone to be out of here. There's a contamination. We don't know how high the levels are. We know that this has happened for over 37 days, and demolish the neighborhood. But they didn't do that. They hid from us, and they're still hiding from us.
What do you mean they're hiding from you?
Well, I mean, the fact that instead of coming out and letting us know what was happening, they had signs up said, please excuse our remodeling at the Exxon station at that time. To me, that's hiding.
Well, now, and I don't know about this. This is just a total aside, but maybe the three of you can shed some light. And Jason, I, you know, as I drive around, there are a number of Exxon stations I've seen that said were closed. We're putting in new pumps. We're putting in new new reservoirs for the gas. Does that mean this could be happening in many places around the area?
Mark, I got to tell you, when I see those signs now, I react a whole lot differently than I did before this case started because Legene is exactly correct. I don't know. I don't know whether to believe those signs when they're put up on an Exxon station or not. I can tell you that when this spill occurred, a sign was put up that said closed for remodeling.
Right.
Within days of that, Exxon took the position that they knew which way the contamination was going. It was going in the southeast corridor, so everybody in the northeast didn't have anything to worry about. And then they come back and say, oh, take that back. Now, meanwhile, everybody's drinking this water. I just don't know. I mean, you can't look at a sign and assume that they're telling the truth that it's closed for remodeling. What the other signs at the various stations represent is anybody's guess. But in our situation, it was an incorrect statement, and it allowed people to continue to drink water that was freshly contaminated. Remember, the position that Exxon's taken now is, you know, we got some of the gas. But look, I mean, during that period, there was 27,000 gallons of raw gas. When they finally got around to checking the monitoring wells at the station, and Legene, tell me if you remember this correctly, I think there was something like 14 feet of gasoline in the monitoring well. I mean,
yep.
It would have lit on fire if anybody was standing by with a match.
So exactly.
It's insane. And, Mark, I do want to make one quick point.
Please.
About MTBE, and that is that MTBE is a chemical kind of caught the environmental community off guard because initially it was a chemical designed to replace lead in gasoline to make gas burn more efficiently. But the reality is that its only application is in gasoline. So the oil companies are the only companies that make this chemical. It's a chemical that's been now banned in over half the states in this country, and the states that now allow it have vastly differing standards of what's allowable for consumption. And in Maryland, the 20 parts per billion is a vanity standard. It's a standard that says when people have been noted to be able to smell and taste it. I mean, I don't know about you, brother, but by the time I can smell gasoline in my coffee, I'm assuming I got a major problem. You know?
No, I'm not laughing at them. Yes, absolutely.
It's a sick thing these people are going through, man, and I just don't know how Exxon can take this position and sleep at night, but they have.
A couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I know the case originally accused Exxon of having known for at least 7 years that not, if not about the leak, then that the detectors themselves were ineffective.
Exactly. Right? And I think there was 99 false alarms. And the one time that it wasn't a false alarm, they did not send anyone out to check. And you can correct me. Is that correct, Jason?
I'm not sure that that's exactly right, and I don't really want to talk about the nuances of the case because it is up on appeal, but suffice it to say that...
Who's appealing?
Exxon's appealing this verdict. Absolutely.
So that means you all have not any money yet?
No.
Oh, no.
No. I see that nobody's gotten a dime yet out of this.
No.
The more important issue is not that nobody's got... These people are stuck in these houses. I mean, regardless of what I might say about MTBE or what Exxon might say, the message from the jury was, look, we wouldn't live in these houses, right? If you were in the market for a house that's $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, some of these houses are over $1 million, then you have choices in which house to buy. And the jury's verdict stood for the proposition that we would never, if we were in the market for a house, buy a house with gasoline in the drinking supply if we had an option not to. And the intention was to give these people an opportunity to get on about their lives, get out of there, and they, to this day, some years after the spill are stuck there, and Exxon's not out of their commitment, and we remain in a legal fight about it.
Now, I'm curious, again, from Legina and Tom Fasanoli's perspective, I'm making no assumptions about what people's lives are like, because it's the first time I've ever seen either one of you. But what has this done to your perspective about just the system itself and the world you thought you lived in, and what this has done to change some of that? I mean, this is pretty shocking from people, I guess, who, you know, go in, buy a house, pay their taxes, law-abiding citizens, and this happens to you. What's it done to the two of you and to your neighbors in terms of your perspective about all this?
Well, it's been very frustrating, to say the very least, and it's been a struggle. I know we have had in our household some disagreements and some struggles with just very basic thoughts about what you're touching on in terms of what do we do? Do we stay? Do we leave? Of course, leaving would be very difficult, and Legina feels very strongly about not wanting to sell the house even if we could, because why give this problem to somebody else? She mentioned something earlier that she wished that Exxon would have just addressed the situation, and certainly I feel the same. My feeling was, and these things have happened before, there's been some precedents with this, with large oil companies where they have a situation like this in a neighborhood and they just come in and buy the houses and take that burden away. Now, that would have satisfied me, but however, and probably Legina, but there are a lot of our neighbors that are just so distraught because this is the neighborhood that they chose to live in. It's a wonderful neighborhood. As you know, we were speaking a little bit off the air, and we decided to go there originally. We've been there for some time because of the schools in the area. Actually, we used to live in Sparks, and that elementary school burned down.
Right.
And then Jacksonville had built their elementary school there shortly thereafter, and we found it to be a wonderful school, and our kids were coming along at that time. So we started looking for a house in this terrific neighborhood, and then now we've been violated, and there are many neighbors that feel that way. So they're very frustrated and confused as to how to proceed.
Legina?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, it's heartbreaking. This was where we built our dream home. We raised our children. This is where we thought, you know, we would be able to stay and retire. We know the community. We're completely around, you know, so many different things that are nearby that you would like to be able to go to. Hunt Valley Mall's right there, and Safeway and Klein's and all these places where it's convenient and you know everyone, and it's a nice group of community of net, you know, people. And and the fact now that, you know, we're up in the air, and we've been up in the air, and this is not something that anyone should take lightly. I mean, it's devastating.
And how old are your children?
Our youngest one now is 21. And, you know, they're in college. Actually, we have one in boot camp right now as we're speaking. Yeah.
Good luck to him.
Yeah.
To him?
Exactly. It's a him.
It's
yep.
Him.
Yep.
Yeah. Good luck to him.
Yeah.
And thank him as well.
Thank you.
But I you know, when you think about people who have children, and oftentimes things that happen to us, medically speaking, health-wise, may have occurred in childhood, but we don't get we're not hit with what happens to us until later in life. I mean, just as parents, that's got to be pretty nerve-wracking and upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, our children were still living at home and going to high school when this happened, because you have to remember, and this has been going on for 4 years. So even though our youngest one is 21, you know, he was still in high school. So there are a lot of things that we couldn't do and enjoy anymore of our home. You know, why would you have a barbecue? You don't want people coming not knowing what was happening. And as people would show up at the house, people were asking us questions constantly, you know, and a lot of people say, well, why don't y'all just get up and move? Where are we going to go? You know, how are you going to leave a house that you still owe a mortgage on?
It makes me think, Jason Tamala, just also about I'm getting ready to interview a fellow tomorrow about his book on factory farming that just came out, that it talks about communities across the country following three families who put up a fight against hog farms being built and what it's done to their water and what it did to the disease in the community and just kind of the battle against that corporate power. And I just – what does it say to you and all of it just about the sense of being in this country and corporate responsibility to its fellow citizens or the lack of it?
Well, it's really disappointing, Mark, throughout the trial and – in the discovery leading up to it, there were gestures made. There were statements made. In the closing statement, you know, Exxon's position was to the jury, hey, tell us what we owe and we'll pay. You know, tell us what we owe and we'll pay. And so the jury says, this is what you owe. And here we are some months later, and they've decided not to do that. It really is a sad testament to the operation of greed and the priority of money over safety, because that's really what happened here. Nobody set out to say, hey, let's go poison an entire neighborhood. What they said was, we don't want to spend the money to make it as safe as it possibly can be. And they got burned taking that risk, looking the other way. And it should be a lesson to, you know, corporate folks around the world and the country that you must be able to prioritize the lives of children and citizens above the capital drive and the desire to please stockholders. If Exxon had spent the money to put in an alarm system that was in the neighborhood of $10,000 when it came to Baltimore and was ready to be installed, this spill would not have happened. It just wouldn't.
It was all about profits.
About the money.
Well, I mean, if it wasn't, then if they said that, what you said they said to the jury, why would they be appealing the case?
Exactly. And, you know, one of the amazing numbers that came out of this, just to put things in perspective, at how large Exxon is and how profitable they are, their profits are so large, even in this down economic time, you know, billions of dollars on a quarterly basis. What we were awarded by the jury, the $160 million, that the number that everybody hears and thinks that we all have money, and of course we haven't received anything yet here, even a year later, and who knows how long the appeals are going to continue to go on. In a week's time, that represents 1 week's profit for Exxon, $160 million, not gross sales, profit.
Hey,
so it would be very easy for them. It's really not even punitive when you think about it on that basis.
It's not punitive at all. It's a strictly compensatory award. And, Tom, I just want to take some issue with you. I think it's much shorter than a week. I don't remember what the numbers were, but Steve Snyder, who really pioneered this case and got it to the finish line and actually got it to the starting line because, I mean, there are two different lawsuits. We've got our verdict and the other one's yet to go to trial. But one of the things that he cleverly did in the opening statement was to run a stopwatch showing how much money Exxon makes per minute. And it's frightening. It's frightening. You're talking about a company that makes, you know, $14 billion in a quarter, and their profits continue to go up in spite of a stale economy. So, you know, their ability to pay is not in question. Their desire to pay is also not in question. It's just regrettable. It should be embarrassing.
And we will say that once again, what you said at the beginning of the show, Jason Tamal, was that even though the Department of the Environment made this decision that Exxon doesn't have to continue checking the wells or delivering bottled water, Governor Martin O'Malley has asked his secretary to reconsider. I think his quote was, he had great concern and wants her to expeditiously and carefully revisit the agency's decision to allow ExxonMobil not to check. So what happens from here? I mean, I'm curious. There's got a couple of levels here, and before we go to break, we'll hear what happens from Jason's perspective, but what happens with your lives? Where do you all go from here?
Well, as it pertains to the incredible inconvenience of the water, what would be easy for them, as Jason talked about, you know, now, you know, we're going to have to go out and purchase water. And, you know, not that that's a great expense, but it's just another expense that we have to take on because we certainly can't drink the water. The MDE has been a source of frustration really from day one. I'm not certainly going to make any accusations, but Jason could probably enumerate all the different times. But they really have almost seemed like they've been in Exxon's camp. There's been many times when they've made some concessions and then we've pushed back or some politicians have helped us push back and they've gone back to the opposite position where they're actually defending us or protecting us, which you would think that they would be doing all along, protecting the citizens more so than a corporation. And I also want to say, because I don't know how this sounds to the listeners, but you know, I'm not, and Legina's not, and most everybody in our neighborhood, no one was in this, did this to be litigious and to just try and get as much money as we can. That's one reason why I spoke about how little money it really is. I mean, it's 89 families in the lawsuit. Their actions, as Jason talked about, were so egregious that that's what made me so motivated to be involved, because I'm not just worried about myself, but we're worried about how they could go on. That's why I said how they could go on and continue to do these kinds of things. To allow this to happen over 37 days and know that it was happening, and also having the opportunity to have prevented it even before it started, knowing that they had a faulty system prior to that, it's just their guilt is so egregious.
And it's still hitting our pocketbook, because we'll have to have our own wells tested, and that is expensive. Yes, because we're going to want to know where we're at on our own levels. You know, so we've already put expense into this lawsuit ourselves. So, and it's a continuance. So it doesn't look like Exxon has done their apology, which is the first thing they said in court that day. They apologize to all of us. I don't see that apology.
Well, some of you, not all of you.
So what is it you think that Exxon's talking about when they say there's going to be a major announcement tomorrow? Any ideas what that might be?
Jason?
I have any idea at all, Mark. I mean, I guess we can all sort of guess given what the news was last week, but I have no idea. I just point out to you that, you know, answer this question. What is the downside of testing water that you know is still in the neighborhood of a toxic contamination? I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen by testing the water? Is you got to pay for the test. You know, what's the worst thing that could happen by giving innocent victims bottled water? You got to pay for the water. And so it just comes down to the money. And it's shameful.
We're talking about the lawsuit that was brought against Exxon for contaminating the water of how many families do we have now? 100? How many families altogether?
Well, there was 89 in our lawsuit, but there were certainly many more than that. And Jason may know the number, but I know the other suit has, I think, 100 or so more.
From the same leak?
From
same
the same
leak.
Spill, yes.
Yes.
Same event.
And we'll see where this all takes us and takes these families, and we're going to see what Exxon has to say tomorrow. And I think that there – I would just say that any of you that live in a neighborhood where you see a gas station shut down because they're putting in new wells, and you better
– don't believe it.
You better check to see what happened to your water and to your community, and just not leave it there, because we've learned all too well that it's difficult sometimes to trust the corporate world and what – at least that part of the corporate world – and what they've done to us. I Legina and Tom Fasanoli, sorry going through what you're going through. Good luck with your future.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for having us on.
To come in. Jason Tamal, thanks for joining us today as well.
Thanks, Mark. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah, we will see each other soon, and we'll stay on top of this, and we'll see what the Department of Environment says after being told by Governor Martin O'Malley to revisit the decision, and we'll see what decisions come back tomorrow from Exxon, and keep you all abreast of this and follow this and follow the folks in Jacksonville and see what's going on. Legina and Tom, thanks. Jason, thanks. We'll talk to you all again. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, offering primary, specialty, and critical care for all children, from the smallest babies to the biggest teenagers. For more information or to learn about their specialty outpatient locations throughout the state of Maryland, call 1-800-492-5538. Late last year, I was in a production of Howard Zinn's People's History here in Baltimore. One of those people in that production was a guy named Ryan Harvey, who works with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he sent me an email last week while we were off about the case of Mark Hall and wanted to know if we were interested in kind of following up on the story. And I looked at it and looked at the website and kind of read more about it and wanted to bring this to your attention because I think it clearly deserves some public airing and people understanding what's going on here. Mark Hall is a veteran, I think, if I have this right, did two tours of duty in Iraq. I was about to say Vietnam, the wrong war. Did two tours of duty in Iraq. And you know we have the system called stop loss in America. Stop loss means that that even if your time is up, the Army can say, stay with us for another year, you're here. He did two tours. The second tour home, his wife had a baby. And when he got his notice to go back to Iraq again, he didn't want to go and wrote this rap song in anger over what was happening to him. And this rap song ended up landing him in the brig. He's in jail. So we're going to talk about this. Our guest this hour, we wish it could be Mark Hall. We can't get to him because he's in a military prison. We're talking to Jeff Patterson, who was a Marine and fought in the first Persian Gulf War and is works with Courage to Resist, an organization that helps conscientious objectors. We're going to come to him first. But first, we're going to play the song that got Mark Hall in trouble. This is an Iraqi veteran who did not want to be sent away from his family. Now, before we start this, even though there are bleeps in the song, because there are like nine times there were deadly words we are not allowed to play on the air. So if you have young children, even though we're bleeped, I want you to know they're in there, so maybe you don't want them to hear it. So that's how I want to let you know that before we play it. This is Mark Hall's rap song that he wrote and produced in his resistance to being sent back to Iraq.
NBC News in depth tonight, back to the front. The number of U.S. soldiers who've had their Iraq military service involuntarily extended under the so-called stop-loss policy is at its highest since the start of the war. That's despite a Pentagon pledge last year to cut back on its use. NBC's Jim Mikleshevsky takes a look at the effect of this controversial policy.
As Sergeant David White was preparing to wrap up his military career last year, he was stunned when the Army refused to let him go.
I was just in disbelief. I did not think that something like that could happen to me.
Instead, White was sent to Iraq for his second combat tour, leaving wife Crystal and newborn Eva behind. What the Army did is slap White with a stop loss, which allows the Army to extend the soldier's enlistment, like it or not.
Yeah, I did a good thing. I'm back from Iraq. I served my country. The only thing on my mind right now is to get down and serve big time with family. What a house man rocking the fruits of my labor. That 14 months of Iraq behavior. Let her stay alive. Shoot that paper, no doubt. I was making that Iraq paper. Now I'm ready to get on out. Become a civilian again and get on out. No car payments, house all decked out. So I'm set to mother. Scream and shout, but success got cost. The army got forced, telling me a like me is stopped lost. That means I can't get out. My salad got tossed. They me over like a mob boss, high horse.
58,000 soldiers have been stopped lost in the past 6 years. Their service involuntarily extended from a few months to more than a year.
Tell me, hey, that's life, motherfuckers, you can't get sprayed. Water guns behave. Nah, this is real days. When hit the airways and somebody gotta say, f*** you, colonels, captains, E7 above. You think you're so much bigger than I am? I've been too good of American. This stop law, stop movement, got me chains and bitched in. If I do drugs, I'll get kicked out. But if my time's up, I can't get out. So the good die young, I heard it out your mouth. So f*** the army and everything you all about.
Army surgeons reattach McKenzie's hand, which now gives him limited use. To this day, McKenzie blames the stop loss. The Army says it uses stop loss to keep soldiers who reach the end of enlistment from leaving the battlefield in the middle of the combat tour.
Like Obama said, somebody be held responsible, but some of y'all gonna be held in hospitals, whatever possible, to pursue my own journeys in life through my like the Copa B. They want me, cause misery loves company. I'm gonna round them up all, eventually, easily. Walk right up peacefully, and surprise them all. Yes, yes, y'all, up against the wall. Turn around, I got a magazine with 30 rounds. On a three-round burst, ready to fire down. Still against the wall, I grab my M4. Spray and watch all the bodies hit the floor. I bet you never stop, lost nobody no more. In your next lifetime, of course, no remorse. Yeah, you don't stop. Yo, the army is the only military branch that still got this stop loss in effect. So only thing I gotta say is prepare for the consequences. When people wanna get out, let them get out.
They don't like it any better than I do, but it has proven necessary in order to maintain the force.
But many lawmakers and critics claim the Army has used stop loss as a backdoor draft to make up for the shortage of soldiers for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It is going to destroy the morale of our troops. We've got to stop it.
And that was the song by Mark Hall that landed him in prison, awaiting court-martial and trial, the United States Army, when he opposed his being stop-loss and sent back to Iraq for the third time. We are joined right now on the phone by Jeff Patterson, who served as a Marine and was the first active-duty military resistor in the Persian Gulf War. He works with Courage to Resist, an organization that helps conscientious objectors. And Jeff Patterson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
I appreciate you taking the time. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. You know, we do a lot of shows here with our veterans and with veterans, with men and women who fought in every war from ours back in the 60s in Vietnam to the ones we're facing now. And we want to hear your thoughts on this, especially those of you who are now returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who have called in here before, to share your thoughts about this court-martial of Mark Hall. 410-319-8888. You don't have to be a veteran, just anybody, just call. So, Jeff, let me talk about this. I mean, so what's your involvement in this? And give our listeners, have you met Mark Hall?
No, I'm located out of California. Mark was in Georgia when he was arrested, and he's a native of New York City. But my role as a project director of Courage to Resist, I spend a lot of the day on the phones talking to people, maybe not in such extreme situations as Mark Hall, but people that are refusing orders in some way, possibly going AWOL. Some of those people have gone to Canada. Other people trying to get out within the system by a conscientious objector discharge, medical discharges, hardship, that kind of thing. You know, people just listen to that song, but I do need to underscore that song. It's sort of a red herring in this case.
How so?
Mark wrote and produced and sent that song to the Pentagon in last July. And there was no doubt that he was angry about being stop-loss. And he wanted to make sure that everybody knew it. And his chain of command, they were mad at him. And they yelled at him a little bit. They sent him to counseling, to make sure that, you know, he wasn't going to actually do anything that he sung about in that song. And at the end of the day, through July, through the summer and fall, they decided that, you know, everything was cool. As long as he's a good soldier and deploys, you know, with the crew, it was no big deal. But then in December, months later, he starts talking about, you know, you remember when you guys took away that weapon from me because you didn't trust me? Well, actually, that's first time I felt good about myself in a while. I actually don't want to carry a weapon anymore, and I want to get out of the Army as a conscientious objector.
Mark Hall said this?
He said that, and he's actually officially applied to become a conscientious objector. You know, and people are interested in, like, in his own words. On our website, couragetoresist.org, we have a letter from him in prison that sort of explains, you know, in detail the process he's gone through. So ironically, it was only when he says, I don't feel like I can go back to war straight up, I don't want to carry a weapon anymore, then they retaliate against him by throwing him in jail for this song. And it's also interesting that myself and the military actually agree on most of this story. Mark Hall came back from Iraq. He served 14 months in combat. He was near IEDs when they exploded. He may have undiagnosed traumatic brain injury, and he certainly has post-traumatic stress disorder. And that really affected him. And his mother, you know, has talked about how he's a changed person. He simply is not the same person. Counselors have said the same thing. Ever since he came back from Iraq, he has gone through multiple counseling sessions with mental health people at Fort Stewart in Georgia. He's tried to see over three different chaplains, asking for help from them. And at the end of the day, the military said, "No, well, you're messed up, but you're good enough to go back." And he said, "Well, that's not good enough." And he filed an official grievance through the Investigator General of the Army for inadequate mental health care. And this is months, this is nearly 4 or 5 months after he wrote this song, but within 2 days of him filing a grievance against the Army, he's put in shackles and he's thrown in jail. So what I see is, like, here's somebody who is a representative of the hundreds of thousands of people serving in the military who are struggling with mental health issues and can't get out. Here's somebody who's actually going to file an official grievance, and the military wants to drop a hammer on them, and they use this song as an excuse to do that.
So one of the, I think,
one of the part of the story.
No, one of the, a very significant piece of this, apparently, which we were talking about a few minutes ago, in the beginning of what you were saying, is that when he wrote this song, when he was being stop loss and sent back to Iraq, sent it to the Pentagon, his immediate commanders had him counseled, said he was okay. So the Pentagon didn't take the song when they sent it, and so we got this guy who's about to mow down his fellow soldiers, and so we have to arrest him now. He didn't get arrested until after he decided, look, I don't want your gun. I don't want to go back to Iraq. I want to be a CO. I've done my time. Let me go home. That's when they put him in jail.
And that's an important thing. He's being charged with 11 separate crimes based on alleged threats he made beginning in July of 2009. But at one point through July, August, October, September, November, none of that did any one of these specific crimes warrant the military actually making an official notation in Mark's record book. There's no non-judicial Article 15 action against him. There's no official counseling statements against him. So this all underscores that it was only until he's like, I actually need real mental health care. I am not stable enough to go back to Iraq. I do not want to carry a weapon. I'm filing an official grievance against you guys for not giving me real health care. And then within hours of that, he's in jail. And he's been in jail since December 12th. And then this is outrageous, and people know that it's outrageous. And we got together a team of attorneys to represent Mark in Georgia. And the military has since retaliated against that by sending him to Kuwait. Here's a guy.
Maybe he's in jail in Kuwait now?
Mark Hall is sitting in a jail in Kuwait right now. So I can't, you know, if I was, I can get some lawyers to volunteer an afternoon of their time, a day or two, to go to Georgia from Birmingham or something to represent this guy. But now supporters of Mark Hall, like myself, we're trying to figure out how do we pay for a U.S. attorney with military law specialty to fly to Kuwait for 2 weeks to represent this guy. And it's, you know, it's a complete violation of Mark's due process, his right to a fair and public trial. We're supposed to be able to, like, go attend his trial. Not if it's in a U.S. military installation in Kuwait. It makes it a lot harder.
Now, we just got a listener who said that, let me read what he said, as in kind of in his outrage, and he said that he can't believe that a person who served his country And this is ridiculous, that someone who has served his country would be thrown in jail for that. He should be freed. What are your thoughts at 410-319-8888? There's so many of you who have called the show during our shows about war and about this war in particular, and about those of you who have served have a lot to say about this and your thoughts. Many of you have called in before talking about how stop loss and what it's done to you, what's done to your families, what's happened to you when that's happened to you. 410-319-8888. We're talking about the case of Mark Hall. We're talking with Jeff Patterson, who served as a Marine and was the first active duty military resistor in the Persian Gulf War and works with Courage to Resist, an organization that helps conscience objectors. 410-319-8888. But he's being sent to Iraq means that he was they want to try him back in his old unit. Is that what he's going to try to do?
Well, we don't know. From what we understand from the public affairs officers in theater over there, is they're going to settle for putting him on trial in Kuwait. Allegedly, the military says that the witnesses they want to use against him are fighting in Iraq, so it's more convenient for them to bring the witnesses from the battlefield around Baghdad to Camp Anjar south of Kuwait City. That's fine because it'll make the life a little bit easier for the military. But what about Mark Hall's rights to have a civilian attorney represent him? What about his rights to have a civilian psychiatrist to actually evaluate him and be able to testify at court-martial for him? What about his rights of family and friends to attend the court-martial for journalists like yourself who might be in the area of Georgia to attend the court-martial? All that's curtailed. So, sure, it's easier for the military, but, you know, they're basically taking away whatever rights Mark has.
Well, and the charges against Mark Hall are pretty serious. I mean, these are charges saying that he would engage in acts of violence against members of his unit, he distributed these things to his unit. Original songs wrongfully threatening acts of violence against members of his unit. This is not a minor issue. He could be facing some time in federal prison.
Yeah, he's looking at a general court martial. If convicted of every single one of the charges, it would be over 20 years in prison. In this context, the military is basically effectively taken away his ability to have a civilian legal team represent him. At this point, he'll simply have a military JAG lawyer, who's a captain in the Army, do what he can on his behalf. But he has no way to appeal to the federal court system on constitutional grounds, and he really is limited to playing within the military law system.
Let me go to the phones here. 410-319-8888, Oz in Delaware, you're on the air. Oz, you there? Oz, turn down your radio so you can join us. Oz, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
We got to turn down your radio so we can hear you. Go ahead.
All right, no, I'm here. My fault on that.
No, go ahead, man. What were you going to say?
I wasn't going to say too much. I just wanted to comment on this case here. And another, I don't know if you guys are familiar about the four guys that have just been put up for court-martial for mistreating a terrorist suspect that they had captured overseas. And I just wanted to say, with the Army not backing us up like this, it makes myself as a new enlistee, you know, I've been in the Army for the past year, it just makes me second-guess, like, what I volunteered my life for.
And you've been in for a year. Have you been to Iraq yet or Afghanistan?
No, fortunately, I haven't been deployed yet. But something that could happen any time. You know, my number could be called any moment. And it's just with hearing cases like this, where this man is in prison in Kuwait and has, you know, no one really to back him up, and he done served his country for years and has been overseas and pretty much done what maybe I'll have to do soon in the future. And it's just like it's unfortunate that the military will treat somebody like this after he, you know, risked his life for several years and served to protect this country.
Oz, I'm glad you're listening, and good luck. And I appreciate you being part of the show today. I think you said something that was very profound and important for our listeners to hear. And I think that, you know, I think what happens all the time, Jeff Patterson, is that, you know, that whenever something goes wrong, like he's talking about the four men who are being charged with torturing a prisoner, we always go after the grunts. We never go after the men who actually make the decisions that this is what people should do.
Well, you know, your caller has a good point that there are many, many people in the military that are outraged at stop loss. It's deeply unpopular. People, you know, people like myself, we signed up for a particular term of enlistment, and we expected to, you know, do that time and be able to leave the military at the end of that term. You mentioned that I refused to fight in Iraq, and part of that was because I was stop lost. I was headed out the door, you know, with my civilian, you know, clothes on when they're saying, well, actually, you guys stay in until the war's over. And that was part of my disagreement. A lot of the calls I take at Courage to Resist today are from people that are being stop lost, and also people that are in the individual ready reserve, meaning that they're able to leave the military, go back into civilian life, and face all the challenges of high unemployment, getting their family life back together. And then, you know, and often as soon as they get their act together and start getting by and making it, the Army sends them a FedEx package saying, you're ordered to report back to active duty service in 30 days, and you'll be deployed for another year.
Jeff, we're just about out of time, and this is really an important case. And I do want to say we're going to cover this again. I want to stay in touch with you so we can stay in touch and know what's going on with Mark Hall's case. And I want to let you know about the Civilian Soldier Alliance, organization of civilian allies working directly with people, servicemen and veterans, toward withdrawing military support from occupations while supporting resistance. Listeners can become further involved Saturday, April 3rd, by participating in a panel, presentation, and dialogue with four local war resistors. The event will take place at 4 o'clock at St. John's Church at 2640 St. Paul Street. And for more information about Mark Hall and upcoming events, and this GI resistance, you can go to info@civsol.org or visit www.civsol.org. And Jeff Patterson, thanks for your service. Thanks for the work you're doing now. And we will stay on top of this and continue to follow the case of Mark Hall and let the world know about it as much as we can.
Thank you very much.
Take care of yourself. Folks, you know, you sign up to fight and serve your country. You need to be treated with more respect and better than that. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gabe Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Felicia, welcome. First night working with us. Good to have you with us. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about what you heard on our shows, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MICU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.